Join the conversation on CFRA Live with Andrew Pinsent. Text 580-580 right now.
And our staff of Keep It Six coming 580-580. Tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. We'll get to those throughout the rest of the show as well. Also still to come this hour is World Cancer Day today. Jay Abramovich is one of several patients sharing his cancer journey at the Ottawa Hospital Foundation this month. He's going to join us coming up in about 10 minutes from now to discuss that journey, talk about kind of easing the anxiety over a cancer diagnosis as well on this World Cancer Day. We'll talk about that coming up. A Chinese spy balloon that we were chatting about in our panel discussion there, it's been found over the U.S. Former intelligence officer with CSIS, Michelle Juneau-Katsoya, is going to join us coming up at the bottom of the hour to talk about that as well. And if you missed it, Science Wire coming up just before 10 o'clock this morning as well. This is CFRA Live. I'm Andrew Pinsent with you until 11 o'clock this morning. We'll reset here with what you need to know for this Saturday, February the 4th. First thing, it's cold outside. An extreme cold warning remains in place here in the capital region with another day of frigid temperatures expected across Ontario and the country, for that matter. Residents being advised to dress warmly and in layers that can be removed, though the outer layers should be wind-resistant. Frostbite can onset within minutes. Currently feeling like minus 38 in downtown Ottawa. We have had the sun come up, but going to feel only like minus 23 by this afternoon. Residents also being asked to check on family, friends, neighbors, and those who are more vulnerable to the extreme weather. Meantime, Winterlude activity set to resume today after Fridays were wiped out because of this extremely cold weather. Launch of Winterlude National Ice Carving Championship postponed until this morning, so that'll go at 10 o'clock. Other events going to resume at noon, including Snowflake Kingdom in Jacques Cartier Park. Visitors being asked to check Heritage Canada's websites for the latest status on events as well. Also asked to bundle up, take some extra precautions if you're going to be outside in this cold as well. A huge high-altitude Chinese balloon sailed across the U.S. on Friday, drawing severe Pentagon accusations of spying on sensitive military sites. Despite China's firm denials, Secretary of State Antony Blinken abruptly canceling a high-stakes Beijing trip aimed at easing U.S.-China tensions. U.S. Congressperson Mike Gallagher is a former intelligence officer himself. He's also the chair of the new House Select Committee on China. He says this has gone on long enough.
We have this incredibly embarrassing optic where this thing is just slowly floating across the United States. It does make us look weak. It makes us look somewhat incompetent, and I wish it had been dealt with much sooner.
The Chinese ambassador was summoned by Global Affairs Canada officials after the Pentagon revealed the presence of that balloon over sensitive military sites in the western U.S. as well. Critics questioning whether the federal government is playing politics with policing. Public Safety Minister Marco Mendicino's office confirming the government wants the RCMP to ban the use of two crowd control tools, sponge rounds and CS gas, which is a milder form of tear gas. RCMP isn't saying if it will comply with this instruction. Head of the National Police Union says removing less lethal options raises real concerns for public and police officer safety. Merritt Stiles expected to be confirmed as the new leader of the Ontario New Democratic Party today at an event in downtown Toronto. Stiles has been a New Democrat MPP since 2018 and was the only person to run for the leadership. She represents the Toronto riding of Davenport, served for years as the party's education critic, and has previously been a school trustee and president of the federal NDP. Stiles has had her focus after being elected will be on defeating PC leader Doug Ford in the next provincial election. That is expected in 2026. Two people facing charges, including a alleged Full Patch Hells Angels member, after police discovered 12 illegal handguns at an Ottawa home. RCMP say officers conducted a search at an Ottawa home last February in support of an international organized crime investigation led by the Winnipeg RCMP. Mounties saying that the probe was targeting illegal drugs and firearms. Two men facing charges related to that. RCMP say one of the accused, 41-year-old Damian Patrick Ryan, is a full-patch member of the Hells Angels with the Attica chapter in Greece. He's arrested in Ottawa, will appear in court February 15th. Warrant issued for a second man in connection to the investigation as well, 28-year-old Azra Ivziku. Firefighters cleaning up a diesel spill on Highway 417 on Friday afternoon after a two-vehicle crash involving a garbage truck happened on the westbound Queensway near Rochester Street around 4:30. Also impacted traffic as well. No one was hurt. Ottawa Fire said roughly 500 liters of diesel leaked because of that crash. All lanes of the highway have since reopened. One Ottawa food bank says it will need to cut back on its food program if it's unable to secure more funds after COVID-19 relief funds came to an end. The Caldwell Family Center, which says it served almost 95,000 meals last year, was able to secure emergency funding from various sources during the pandemic, including the province. That provincial COVID-19 relief fund is coming to an end for many organizations next month. And Executive Director Marilyn Matheson says that some people it serves will be in trouble if it can't secure more funding. Center says it's also struggled with inflation and rising food prices. Ottawa officially launching its search for its next city manager. A hiring panel composed of Mayor Mark Sutcliffe and three city councilors approved the hiring of Ogders Bernston to assist the search for a new top bureaucrat. This happened on Friday. They also established a timeline for the recruitment and appointment process. You'll remember Steve Kanellakos resigned in November as city manager, 2 days before the release of the public inquiry's final report into stage one of Ottawa's light rail transit system. Council appointed Treasurer Wendy Stevenson as interim city manager at that time. The goal is to consider the appointment of a new city manager by May. Calgary pastor Arthur Pulaski will have to wait to find out if he's guilty on a number of charges, including mischief in relation to the Coutts border blockade last February. Pulaski's 20-minute speech to the truckers urged them to stand their ground and that the eyes of the world were on them. There were some tense moments on Friday afternoon, Pulaski trying to talk to the prosecutor after he'd mispronounced his name through the trial. Outside court, he told reporters it was disrespectful.
This is my life, and this is my last name, so at least you could do an effort after a year of persecuting an individual to learn how to pronounce that individual's last name. His dismissal, he's like, whatever, I don't care about you. I don't care about your feeling. You mean nothing to me.
The judge told the court it could be several weeks before he returns a verdict. Arrest of a 24-year-old man accused of taking two monkeys from the Dallas Zoo has shed some light on some mysterious string of events that have been happening there. Authorities saying on Friday they've also linked this man to the escape of a small leopard and a gash in the fence of another monkey habitat. Dallas Police Department spokesperson Kristen Lohman announcing that arrest.
On Thursday night, Dallas police arrested Davion Irving, 24, in connection with the Emperor Tamarin monkey case that was here at the Dallas Zoo. Preliminary investigation and help from the public identified him as the man that we were looking to speak to regarding this case.
Now, the two Emperor Tamarin monkeys named Bella and Finn went missing from their enclosure on Monday. They were found uninjured Tuesday in the closet of a vacant home in a Dallas suburb. And no winning tickets sold for last night's Lotto Max jackpot. You'll have to try again on Tuesday. $10 million draw last night, this coming Tuesday, February 7th. Be worth roughly $15 million. That's what you need to know for this Saturday, February the 4th. We'll take a quick break here on CFRA Live. When we come back, it is World Cancer Day. We'll hear the journey of one survivor at the Ottawa Hospital. This is CFRA Live.
On the go? Take News Talk 580 CFRA Ottawa with you. Download, listen, and learn through the iHeartRadio app. Now back to CFRA Live with Andrew Pinsent.
919, freezing cold out there. Make sure you're dressed for the weather if you're heading outside. Currently feeling like minus 38 out there with the wind chills. So still under that extreme cold warning. So make sure you are staying safe out there. You know, everybody, we have been chatting a lot about Winterlude kind of kicking off today, but today also marks World Cancer Day. And several patients have been sharing their own personal journeys to kind of make it more easy for those who are going through that very difficult journey themselves. Jay Abramovich was just 36 when he learned that he had stage 3B colon cancer, and his journey has been one fraught with the unknown. He joins us this morning to chat a little bit about that. Jay, thanks so much for joining us on a Saturday morning, and good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
And I know, no problem at all. Thanks so much for sharing your story. I know a lot of people have been sharing their stories with the Ottawa Hospital Foundation this month. And just when we think of this, you know, immediately, I'm 33 myself. So when I read, you know, Jay, that you were 36 when you were first diagnosed, it gives you pause, right? Because we think of this as an older person's disease or what have you. So just how difficult was that for you at age 36 to kind of receive that diagnosis? And, you know, how did you feel about it?
Yeah, well, I think it was a complete shock to me and my family, to be honest. I, like myself or in my family, there's no history of colon cancer. I was healthy before. I really didn't have any predispositions. And as you kind of mentioned, it really wasn't on the radar because someone who's 36 and, sorry, in the prime of their life and kind of just figuring stuff out isn't really supposed to have to worry about something like cancer. And it's not something that really is typically known. And I think that's something that is one of those big problems right now that, you know, as you kind of mentioned, a lot of folks do think it is an old person type of disease. But, you know, I've connected with tons of folks and, you know, in some support groups that are purely for young adults. And it's out there. It's actually, you know, I was quite shocked at how common of a problem it is. And yeah, it was frustrating. It was scary. It kind of put life on pause for myself and my wife. And when you're, again, when you're 36 years old, just kind of in the prime of life and think you have things figured out and you get the rug pulled out from under you. And it's, yeah, it's kind of definitely life-changing and it's a punch in the gut for sure.
Well, and it feels also just like this inherent feeling of just, you know, being unfair, really.
Oh, absolutely. It's very much the, you know, the, every time, you know, when I do share my story, I think it's important to really look at the mental health side of things because we also, you know, we often hear about like surgeries and chemotherapy and radiation and all that stuff that like you see on TV and the movies or, you know, that really is known about cancer. But and that's true. That's definitely true. But the one part that's not really ever talked about mainstreamly anyway, or enough yet, is the like the mental health effects that it has on somebody. Like it completely ravages every part of your being. Like you no longer think the same, you no longer trust the same. Like everything kind of changes as soon as you hear that diagnosis.
Yeah, and one can only kind of think about that, let alone even think about the experience of that. I guess how did you deal with that initial anxiety through that diagnosis? I guess from what I've read, you also had some help down at the Ottawa Hospital Cancer Center as well.
Yeah, I was kind of, you know, I wouldn't say I was fortunate coming into this, but I think I was maybe a little bit more loaded coming into this diagnosis as I, you know, as I had battled some mental health diagnoses in the past. So I did have a few things in place already that I was able to tap into. But obviously, these were unknown waters, right? Hearing you have cancer and now being on this unknown, terrifying journey. So, you know, first of all, like my family, my wife, my parents, my brother, huge, huge, huge supports, emotionally, and were basically my rocks for, you know, and still continue to be as I work through all this stuff. But the folks at the Ottawa Hospital, were just phenomenal. Like I went through all of this dead smack in the middle of the pandemic. So pretty much, well, I would say every appointment, surgeries, all of my 6 months of chemotherapy until my very last one, I was by myself essentially. Like my wife couldn't come in with me.
Right.
So she was called into, like she was called in or FaceTimed into appointments. I had to walk into the infusion center to do my 6 months of chemo by myself. I woke up from surgery by myself, simply because of the rules that were in place at the time. So those folks at the cancer center, at the civic campus that I had my surgery at, like they kind of stepped in and replaced my family, to be honest with you.
Hey, for better or for worse, right? And just, oh man, thinking about some of the restrictions on hospitals, it hit people in so many different ways. And you're kind of describing one of the big ones there. Just, you know, between we've got a diagnosis now, and then now, you know, you're just a, we'll call it a regular dad. You're helping others kind of work through, you know, the Man Up to Cancer program as well. But just, you know, the in-between here where we're talking very, you know, positive and optimistically versus back during getting that diagnosis, just, you know, what has it been like that in between time, that kind of black hole?
Yeah, well, it's been an interesting, to be honest, it was an interesting time because you obviously go through like the gamut of emotions of pretty much every emotion you can imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
And you kind of get to a place where you really have to decide, and this is very individual, but everybody from what I've experienced and people that I've met, everybody kind of gets to a place where you kind of hit a really dark, scary, deep place, and you have to make a choice, right, of how you're going to move forward and what it's going to look like. And that could look very different, right? And, you know, for some people, that could look like shutting down, and they really are in a very dark place for a very long time. They could be alone. They could really be not in a good place mentally, physically, and, you know, the combination of that is even worse. Or you have choices of utilizing the resources out there, or, you know, not isolating and surrounding yourself with people and to help you kind of get through things, which ultimately opens the doors to other resources and kind of supports that you could utilize. Because, I mean, there are, like, the fact of the matter is, like, being a guy especially, a lot of support groups that I attended were great. You know, there's a lot of awesome things out there. The cancer community is amazing. But the, you know, the reality of it is it's very female-dominated. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that at all. But simply being a guy in that world kind of adds another barrier, right? And there are a lot of studies and stuff that are showing now that men, of course, as we know with everything, are, you know, we delay going to the doctors, we're less likely to ask for help, we try to tough it out, and, you know, we don't need anybody, we're going to do it on our own. And you learn pretty quickly with something like cancer that you can't do that. it'll turn you inside out and hang you out to dry, right? So you really have to, and I was very fortunate to find some great resources that were very driven towards men specifically, and Man Up to Cancer being one of those that was huge in my, like, huge in my story, because it kind of gives you a place where you belong. And their whole mission there is, you know, their whole purpose is so men don't isolate while facing cancer. And that's huge, right? Like, we're seeing that that could change outcomes, like, not whether you might get, I'm not talking cure wise, but months and years on someone's life if they, if, you know, unfortunately, if that's the course that their disease is progressing. But ultimately, it does make a huge difference. And I'm helping a lot that way now, too. Like, I've become quite involved with them. I'm one of their admins on their Facebook group. I'm actually just got asked to be their member coordinator on, like, an organization level. So I just feel, yeah, it's just a really important thing to get those supports, as you mentioned, to people, whether you're whatever you identify as, but not isolating and utilizing, you know, the all those resources that the hospital and the community here in Ottawa that we're super fortunate for has.
You know, as you mentioned, it is particularly men with the more issues with kind of reaching out for help on that front. Just we've seen kind of a shift in the last, you know, few years, perhaps decade, just I guess reiterating how important kind of some of this early screening is and kind of seeing your doctor for regular physicals and things like that.
Yeah. You know, we do know that colon cancer is one of those cancers that is extremely preventable and treatable if caught early, right? And the only way to catch the tricky thing about colon cancer, right? I'm not a medical professional, so I'm not going to speak too much to that. But the general information out there, right, is get those screenings. Like, I know, and the screenings need to be younger, right? Like, it's 50. It's talked about being 45, but, like, I'm 36 or I was 36, right? And I had no signs. I had very few signs or symptoms. And if I wouldn't have got to my doctor for some of the symptoms I had, I wouldn't have been screened until I was, you know, until I was 50. And it definitely wouldn't have been stage 3 at that point. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, it's that whole thing about it being a older person's disease, which is not the case, right? Like, they're statistics and stuff are showing now, like by 2026-ish, they're saying, like, colon cancer is going to be the number one cause of death for adults between 19 and 49. Right. So, like, that's wild.
Yeah. It's, right?
I remember walking into my doctor's office, like, my GP is phenomenal. She was great. She had a student with her that day that full out looked at me and said, oh, you're young. You don't have to worry about colon cancer. Right. And I hope, like, it infuriated me at the time, but I hope that, like, that's a lesson to that young doctor, that will never happen again, right? Like, yeah. I'm in a group with, I could name dozens of people under the age of 40 that, you know, have passed away from colon cancer, even in the last 2 years.
And it's why it is even important to kind of talk about it on days like this and to kind of talk about these stories as well. So, Jay, thank you so much for sharing that this morning. I really appreciate it.
No, I appreciate the time. I'm always fortunate to be able to speak and share my experiences with, you know, whether it be the Ottawa Hospital, the Cancer Center, Man Up to Cancer, and just in general, just to bring awareness because, you know, it is a young person's disease. It's happening. It's out there. Like it's happened to me. So if anything could provide some support and insight to anybody out there, I had some amazing help during my journey and I just hope that I could pay that forward a little bit. So I appreciate any opportunity I get to speak.
Oh, hey, thank you for paying that forward, Jay. Thanks so much. Good luck moving forward.
Thanks very much.
Jay Abramovich, cancer survivor himself, just talking about some of the anxiety surrounding that cancer diagnosis, some of the help he received at the Ottawa Hospital Cancer Center. Today is World Cancer Day, so take a moment to reflect on that. We'll take a quick break. This is CFRA Live. We'll be right back after the news.
They shot a movie once in my hometown. Everybody was in it for miles around. Out at the speedway, some kind of Elvis thing. Well, I ain't no movie star, but I can get behind anything. Yeah, I can get behind anything.
Cause I'm good and I'm feeling alright. Baby, I'ma have the best freaking night of my life. And
this is CFRA Live with Andrew Pinsent on News Talk 580 CFRA and the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome back. This is CFRA Live. China downplaying the cancellation of a visit by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, saying neither country had formally announced the visit to begin with. Blinken was set to visit Beijing tomorrow for talks aimed at reducing tensions between the two countries, but Washington scrubbed the trip after the discovery of a large Chinese balloon suspected of conducting surveillance on U.S. military sites. China insists it's a weather research airship. Joining us to chat about that this morning is Michelle Juneau-Katsuya, former senior intelligence officer with CSIS. And Michelle, thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
When you first saw this, you know, when I was initially seeing this story, it's just like, you know, this is happening all the time in the background, but it was just kind of strange to see something like this out in the open like this. Is that what kind of drew you about this too?
Well, yes, effectively, you know, some people call it a sort of a spy balloon or something like that. But there's an element with the spying that usually that goes with it, the element of being discreet and secret. There's nothing secret about this huge balloon, which is about three football field large. Everybody could see it and everything. So there's two things that comes to mind. Was it intentional or really an accident? Those big balloons usually are equipped with a piece of equipment to literally blow the balloon and let the balloon go in the ocean when you lose control of it. Now, this balloon left China, went all the way north to North Pacific, went over Alaska, went over Canada. Now it's moving in the middle of America without control, without direction. So it's either one thing that the Chinese have done that intentionally in order to embarrass the American, because basically last year, let's remember last fall, the Americans and even a Canadian delegations, two different delegations went to Taiwan and they didn't like it at all. They didn't like it at all. So is it sort of a form of retribution where they're trying to embarrass Mr. Biden and his administration? Knowing that the Republicans are going to probably enjoy sort of torturing Mr. Biden with that? Or is it really sort of a form of incompetence? Well, there's maybe a third element. Is there somebody intentionally within the Chinese government that wanted to deteriorate the relationship between the Americans and the Chinese, knowing that a week from now there was supposed to be this this meeting, as you mentioned in the introduction. So one way or the other, it's a big boo-boo now for the Chinese. They look incompetent. They look like they don't know what they're doing. And if it was something done from the inside to embarrass the inside or to deteriorate the relationship with the Americans, again, it doesn't look really good. But there's definitely sort of a subtext here. If that was the last option was in function, is that there is definitely some a really radical element within the Chinese government who don't want, who doesn't want to have any good relationship with the Americans, and that could be sort of the break of greater tension, provided the right circumstances.
Well, and it's fascinating, kind of laying out the different options that could be at play here, but. In the way that China has responded here, it caught me off guard in a sense of just, you know, China standing up straight and saying, hey, this was us taking responsibility and we're sorry. It kind of flies in the face of how China kind of handles things. I guess, does that reaction tell you anything in terms of, I guess, what the options that are possible here?
Well, this is a little bit like the Chinese reaction is very puzzling because they knew that they lost this balloon and for a long period of time. Now, if they knew that this balloon was on its way to North America and they could not destroy it remotely, they needed to be capable to inform the Americans and say, hey, guys, sorry, we lost the balloon. It's on its way. Sorry. We didn't do it on purpose. They didn't do anything of that nature. They waited until it's way inside the American airspace and then the Canadian airspace, and then eventually timidly said, oh, yeah, it's ours. It's only a weather balloon and stuff like that. Definitely here, a lot of people are talking about, should we shoot down the balloon? At this point, it's not the right time to do it, because when you decide to shoot the balloon down, you take the responsibility of what's going on and what will happen when this big piece of equipment goes down. And if, God forbid, it falls on a populated area, but then you got to sort of clean up the mess. And it's a big thing. If you send warbirds in order to shoot it down, then you got to send also the military to retrieve it. And God forbid, like I said, falls onto a populated area. So it becomes a big mess. So for the time being, it's better to let it drift and hopefully sort of capture it later, if at all, just to find out what kind of equipment was attached to it.
And as you mentioned, you know, there has been many politicians and other kind of experts in the U.S. saying, hey, just shoot it down on that aspect. From an intelligence perspective, though, do you see any value in capturing this balloon and bringing it, back to base?
Well, definitely we want to know what kind of equipment was there, because we want to sort of irradiate for good if that was a spy balloon or not. The Chinese claims it is only a weather balloon that went awry. Well, let's find out if it's only a weather balloon. But definitely shooting it down at this point was not the right thing. And at this point, the longer you wait, the better it is for the American, because the Chinese now looks really, really bad. And to play too fast, that option will not sort of serve you. But definitely we want to know what kind of equipment is there. And, you know, if it was a question of spying on those sites or any sites at all, the Chinese have much more sophisticated ways to do it. They have spy satellite. They can send spy birds. They can send drones, all sort of things to be capable to sort of capture much more information than something that is so obvious, so slow, and so regarded and so looked at by the rest of the world.
And China has these satellites that are spying on infrastructure, 24/7 on that aspect. So I guess, does that also, I guess, tell you that there's something else going on here with just the facet in which this has, been used? A weather balloon versus, the millions of amazing technologies that the Chinese have access to.
And that's because it's so big, as you point out. This is so big. why not shooting it down before? That's another thing as well. If the Chinese were embarrassed about it, they could have intercepted the balloon when it was still over the Pacific Island, the Pacific Ocean, and shoot it down, and everything would have been destroyed and lost at sea, and no fault, no problem. But at this point, they let it go so far. So why did it go so far? Why did it go unattended for such a long period of time? That's why the third third element, that somebody intentionally let it go because it wanted to destroy the relationship or damage the relationship between the Chinese and the Americans, were on the eve of an important meeting with the State Department.
Fascinating world that we're living in. But Michelle, thank you so much for your time and your perspective on this morning. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Have a great weekend.
You too. Michelle Gino-Katsoya, former senior intelligence officer with CSIS, is sharing his thoughts on that wayward Chinese balloon still making its way over the U.S. We've seen a second reported balloon, apparently closer to Latin America. The Pentagon yet to confirm that. We'll continue to follow that story throughout the rest of the morning as well. Lots of good text on this as well. But just another text to pass out before the break. Dan from Barhaven saying, an outage reported by Scotiabank. Servers are down. The bank isn't even answering my calls at the branch. So just be aware of that if you're banking with Scotiabank. Seems like some issues this morning as well. 9:46. We'll take a quick break. The Science Wire coming up after this. Then we'll have the 10 o'clock news. We're with you until 11 o'clock this morning. Welcome back to CFRA Live. It is time for the Science Wire with Dr. Rob Thacker at St. Mary's University in Halifax, our weekly look at the world of science and technology. Rob, good morning once again.
Good morning, Andy. How's it going?
Not too bad. How about you?
Pretty good, thanks.
This one kind of covering, I guess, science, tech, some espionage. There's a whole bunch of stuff with this first story that's a very weird one. An alleged spy balloon over the U.S. It turns out, actually, is a weather device. We'll talk about the foreign relations aspect of this kind of a little bit later. But this is allegedly a weather device.
Well, it's really interesting that we won't know until it comes down. I find this story absolutely fascinating. I mean, high altitude balloons were a sort of like stock and trade of espionage if you go back to the Cold War. And what's really changed in the last few years is that there's now new technology in these balloons that allows them to stay up for longer. Literally, the helium is no longer allowed to leak out very slowly. They're completely contained now. And also the thing that allows them to stay up longer and be more useful is that there is brand new techniques in what's called station keeping. So keeping the balloon over a certain area. So I just kind of wonder whether this is the Chinese saying, hey, we've got our station keeping technology all down and we're keeping our balloon right where we want it. Have a look, Americans. So it's kind of an interesting situation, if I'm really honest.
I was kind of hearkening back to that when I was first reading this story as well, during World War II, balloons used for espionage. And just in terms of what exactly is being captured here, one can imagine that the technology has advanced somewhat as well, with our ability to capture images at such tiny cameras.
Well, I think the thing that you've got to think about and what is interesting with this whole station keeping idea is with the satellite, you're going around the Earth every sort of like 90 minutes and so on. So you get a picture, you move on, you get another picture of another area, and you move on. You keep going round and round and round. But if you have a balloon that's, what, 25, 26 kilometers up, and it's staying right over there, you can literally see what's happening in time. And that's where my head has gone with this. If there was some kind of espionage to this, perhaps it's about literally being in one place to be able to consistently monitor. If you have more than one satellite, of course, you can do that. But at the end of the day, my guess is that may be what this is perhaps about. But I mean, who knows? It's just a remarkable story to watch unfold in real time. One side says one thing and the other side responds to it with another thing.
And I guess you mentioned satellites. I guess, can you see a practical use of why you would use something like a balloon instead of a satellite for this instance?
Yeah, they're cheaper is one, but in terms of being able to resolve things that are smaller, the lower down you are, I mean, you're a quarter of the height of probably most operational spy satellites, I would guess, if not lower than that. And so when you start looking at things, you're able to see them effectively four times bigger. So that's really going to help any kind of resolution issue. Now, all of that said, of course, they do have, I'm sure, very large spy satellites with really massive, massively long telephoto lenses up in orbit as well. So, but purely from a pay perspective, this does give them sort of like the opportunity to do something more cheaply. I mean, we have the same thing, funnily enough, in astronomy, that instead of putting up space telescopes, we can sometimes put telescopes on a gondola, on a balloon, and have them up there for a sort of like 3 months and then get a really good data set from that.
That when you put, I guess, satellites and things up there, is that the thought that, especially over some of these more sensitive areas, is that they are going to be seen eventually. I guess, is there anything to be said about, any kind of cloaking technology that's being used here or anything like that?
Not in this case. It's really, really difficult to cloak things on an optical basis. There are ways of cloaking things in sort of like, I think, microwave and radar levels. But optically, once there's sun on this thing, you see it. So it's really difficult. So that's why I find this really just a really funny story, because there's something going on here, and it's just really, really curious to know what it actually is. Perhaps we'll never know, but it's such an unusual story. I'm deeply, deeply intrigued by it.
Next story this week as well, maybe bad news for chess players, but more broadly as well. But it turns out, new study has found that chess experts make more mistakes when the air pollution is high. What does this mean for I guess, how our body reacts?
Yeah, well, so this is something that's been done in a very straightforward way by looking at how chess players make their moves and then comparing them to what the most optimal ones are determined by a computer. And so they tracked a number of different ways of polluting the air. So I think they had CO2 monitors, right? And so they also had monitors that were looking at the concentrations of particulates. So anyone who has a wood-burning fireplace or something like that will be concerned about particulate, tiny things like 2.5 microns or less in diameter. And so what they found is if you have air that has this, and so they've checked this by sort of like looking at various locales and so on of where events happened, then there was a 2% probability that there would be mistakes, or 2% higher probability that mistakes would be made by the players. Now, 2%, honestly, that's not very much. Let's be honest. But the key thing in the study is that not only was there that 2%, when they made a mistake, it was 10% more likely to be something that was really significant to the play out of the game, like a really significant tactical error. And I think that's what makes this interesting, because 2% by itself isn't so significant, but the fact that they were making these sort of like more significant mistakes was something that's going to make sort of some of the top players sit up and take notice about this. Although apparently some of them already have, right? Some of them take CO2 and particulate air monitors to the tournaments to know what they're dealing with. So it's a game of small margins as well, of course.
That's incredible to think that it's a variable within the kind of chess community itself. But just kind of thinking out kind of more broadly as well, the thought that when we're under pressure and the air level is very high as well, that we're more prone to make mistakes.
Yeah, so obviously my head is from chess players, I go to people doing like international negotiations. So probably not a good idea to do those around a fireplace.
Yeah, fair enough.
So I don't know. I think this will certainly make a few people think about it. I mean, there is obviously a lot more interest now post-COVID in the indoor air quality, right? And so having data like this is a really interesting contribution to that conversation as well.
Yeah, no kidding. And last story up this week is Japanese researchers have looking into kind of how to detect brain tumors. They found kind of a less invasive way than the typical brain or a kind of blood work that we normally do. They're using urine in this case. It's kind of a big breakthrough.
Yeah, so I will put a sort of careful caveat on this. This is something that's come out of the university where the researchers are at. It is a published paper. So that's all legitimate. But really, brain cancer is one of those things that is actually quite difficult to detect. I mean, in the article itself, it talks about it essentially detecting them as unchanged for over 20 years. And so the real issue is the late detection. Very often, it's only realized when sort of like you have neurological symptoms like slurring of speech and or even issues with movement and things like that. And by that time, many people will know it's essentially the tumor is significantly problematic by that time. So having something that will detect essentially there are what we call biological markers associated with the brain tumors that will pass throughout the body and be passed out in urine as well. And so this particular piece of research, rather than doing it with a blood test, many people may know for prostate cancer, there's the PSA, the prostate-specific antigen that appears in blood. That's one way that's used to detect cancers early. But this would be even less invasive than that. I mean, literally from just testing your urine. So if it works in detail, I will say the paper or the review that I've seen doesn't give overall sort of like detection rates at the moment. But I'm sure there'll be a lot more sort of investigation into how this works over time. And I'm sure as well, because this is about using a specific type of detection technology, that we'll see more interest or more applications of this down the line if it is effective too.
Well, and even just more broadly to the healthcare system, you know, I guess how important is it for, you know, breakthroughs like these when, or alleged breakthroughs like these, when we were able to kind of have earlier detection of some major diseases? Because obviously that takes a lot of strain off our healthcare system and for the individual.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you can have these be made so simply that you can literally like do mail outs to people. Like, so for example, now we have colon cancer mail outs to people. So anything like that where you can literally almost automate the whole thing is going to be really, really useful on top of having, as you said, that ability to detect things early. So yeah, big part of it, I think we'll be seeing more and more technologies in the future that look fundamentally at early detection.
Fascinating stuff. We'll leave it there for this week. Rob, thanks once again.
Always a lot of fun. Thanks, Andy.
And that's Dr. Rob Thacker at St. Mary's University with our weekly look at the science and tech world, the Science Wire, which you can hear each Saturday here on CFRA Live at 6:50 and 8:50. Take a quick break. We'll be right back here on News Talk 580 CFRA.